Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground.
Yes, we won't back down, and we will stand our ground. This is Paul Fromm subbing this morning for Don Black, who is on his way, of course, to the Stormfront Conference in East Tennessee, which will be held this weekend. I'm a regular co-host with Don, and do we have Don Advo with us this morning?
Yes, we do. Can you hear me, Paul?
Yes, loud and clear. Don, how are things out your way?
Pretty good. Not much change. Same old thing out here behind the lines in Mexican-occupied California. We have a lot freer than in Canada. I'm sorry for Canada, but glad that we have the freedom here that we do. But so, are you attending the conference?
No, as you may know, I was required by Homeland Security late in June to obtain a visa. Of course, I've never had trouble getting into the States before, and I was promised after answering all manner of questions that I would have my visa in 90 days. That would have been the end of September, somewhere around the 10th or 12th of October, when I still hadn't heard, I contacted them. Of course, you can never reach a human being. You have to do everything by email. I don't know what one would do if one was in the pre-internet age, but anyway, I contacted them. I was simply snippily advised that they were still processing my application. So the long and the short of it is I will not be going to the Stormfront Conference, and this will be the first one I've missed. I'm more than a little annoyed, because I think this is outright political discrimination. I was on the way in late June to a conference of the American Freedom Party down your way, actually down in California. I was going to be in Bakersfield, and I was stopped at the airport in Toronto. And you go through Homeland Security in Canadian airports rather than when you get to the States. And the long and the short of it seemed to be, they didn't like the American Freedom Party. They told me it was white supremacist. Well, frankly, whether they are or they're not, it shouldn't matter in a country that, you just told me has freedom. Then when I went for my interview for my visa, along with, the usual type of questions, I was asked some very, what I took to be extremely provocative, in fact, racist questions. I was asked, when did I immigrate from Germany? Well, I never did immigrate from Germany. I was born in Latin America because my dad was in the oil business. And it says that on my passport. I mean, there's no big mystery there. A moment or two later, did my father serve in the German army? I thought, well, even if he had, so what? I said, no, he served 3 years in the Royal Canadian Navy, and my mother was served 6 years in the Canadian as a nurse in the Canadian Army. But even so, I mean, even if they had been in the German Army, so what? I took that to be just real German bashing. I thought they're probably trying to provoke me into saying or doing something a little bit rash, but. Anyway, I can console myself that while I'm not going to go to the Stormfront Conference, I'm sure you've got at least 10,000 illegals, many of them criminals, rapists, and murderers sneaking up from Mexico within the same time. So both our systems are absurd.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. I don't know that I've ever heard you talk about what you think of the Donald Trump phenomenon. It's, of course, very significant here in the United States. He's the number one in the polls for the Republican Party, and he seems to have struck a very, very powerful note with his pledge to build a wall and deport 11 million illegal aliens. What's your personal assessment of him, and has there been any reaction in Canada to his candidacy here in the United States?
Well, I think what official reaction I've seen tends to be dismiss him as a loudmouth and a, well, you know, typical American. I mean, he just says anything that's on his mind, which, of course, is, I think, one of the reasons he's become so popular, that he isn't the standard politician, you know, even, well, maybe with a couple of exceptions among the Republicans, just mouthing political correctitudes or saying virtually nothing. Trump, I'm not sure what to make of him. Certainly he's outspoken, and that's good. Secondly, he's so wealthy, he isn't going to be dependent on prostituting himself to the usual suspects and moneyed interests. On the other hand, he's pro-Israel, which is bad. He certainly speaks common sense about illegal immigration, and it's so obvious. And I think the average guy driving a taxi, or the average woman, pouring coffee in a restaurant, gets it. You've got problems with people sneaking in illegally over the border. Duh. What can we do? We can't deport them all. Trump says yes, you can. It's like saying, well, there's so many robbers, we can't put them in jail. Sure, arrest them, give them a trial, and if they're found guilty, put them in jail. It's obvious. And there's been this official head-scratching in both parties for, you know, 20 years. What can we do about the border? He's like, well, I don't know. That's a tough one. He says, build a wall. Well, obviously. Build a wall. The average person can relate to that. If you've got people pouring in, you know, even if on your own property, if people are trying to do mischief in your backyard, you build a wall. You enclose your property. And the thought that the world's largest military power cannot secure its border is terrifying. It's a failure of will on the part of the most of the American political establishment, and Trump is the man who has cut through that nonsense with clear common sense. Build a wall. Well, the Hungarians just faced that problem in the summer, and they're a much poorer and a country than the United States, and their president Viktor Orban built a wall, and you know that's obvious. The other thing that does encourage me, I think it was just over the weekend that Trump said that America had made mistakes in foreign policy, the getting rid of Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi had been a big mistake. That what had followed was chaos, and you know he is the little boy. Well, I guess he's not such a little boy, but he's there at the parade pointing out that the emperor is buck naked. He's not wearing a beautiful new cloak. And the intervention in Iraq was a disaster. That was one more war for Israel, and what did it do? What did it accomplish? I think it was something like 6,000 American dead, probably 10,000 have come back horribly maimed and damaged, 600,000 Iraqis dead, and $2 trillion in American treasure gone. To accomplish what? It's chaos in Iraq today. Under Saddam Hussein, there was order. It was actually a relatively progressive society. Women had rights. Women didn't have to go around in a bag. In Saddam Hussein's Iraq, half the doctors were women. There was a rising middle class. Was it an American-style democracy? No. But should America, and by extension Canada, go swaggering around the world telling people they've got a regime change? Same thing in Libya. Gaddafi was, a bit, in my opinion, a weirdo, but he'd been in power since 69. There was order in Libya. And he made a speech about 10 years ago, and I never could quite figure out, and it might have been the translation, whether it was a threat or a statement. But he said, if it weren't for him, millions from Africa would come to Europe. Now, as I say, you'd almost have to know Arabic and the language he was speaking to know exactly what the, you know, was it a threat or just a statement? Anyway, the West, with its bombing, allowed his enemies to win the Civil War. So the Canada, the United States, Britain, Italy, and France all ganged up on him. And sure, he lost and he got murdered by the roadside. You know, that I don't think is what we Trump wanted. And what do we have in Libya today? Complete chaos. There's nobody in charge. There's weapons everywhere. ISIS is operating openly. Al-Qaeda is operating openly. And they are the major staging ground for probably a half a million, mostly Africans, who've poured across the Mediterranean into Europe this year, exactly as Gaddafi said. Gaddafi didn't allow boats to leave these people smugglers and so on to use his territory as a launching ground. So once again, to please Israel, we took out a man who created stability there. And, whether one thought he was the greatest ruler or not, results chaos. And Trump said that he's probably one of, as far as I know, he's the first major American politician other than Ron Paul, who has said America's meddling in the Middle East has been a disaster. I find that encouraging. Do I trust him 100%? No, but he certainly looks to me like the best of the lot. And the fact that he's not dependent on other people for money is also encouraging.
Well, I agree with everything you say. Like you, I am very heartened by his comments about the Iraq war. About Libya, one of the things I've noticed is that in the lead up to the war against Iraq, of course, Iraq had was, as you say, a very stable and a very orderly society. But one thing you notice about pre 2003 Iraq, its main export was oil. They didn't export people. You didn't see floods of refugees leaving Iraq. Now that the country has been bombed and liberated, an American-style democracy installed there, suddenly it is producing hundreds of thousands of refugees. And the same thing is true of Libya and now of Syria. When American-style democracy is installed and American liberation is achieved, suddenly a lot of people are interested in running away from that society. And it used to be that a society with hundreds of thousands of its citizens wanting to run away was a trademark of communist countries such as the USSR or East Germany, which very famously, or very infamously, I should say, built the Berlin Wall to keep its own people from escaping the workers' paradise. And of course, we have a situation in the Caribbean today where many thousands of Cubans risk their lives to leave the workers' paradise that was installed in that country so they can come here. But I do think it is significant that before American wars in the Middle East, these countries, they may have produced a few expatriates and malcontents who were at odds with the powers that be, but they did not produce many, many hundreds of thousands of refugees. And I think that's a very important point, because whether people run away from a society or run to a society, I think is a very telling thing, far more telling than platitudes and slogans about making the world safe or democracy or anything else for that matter.
I think that's a really good point. Another result of this meddling are these refugees. And the same thing's happened in Syria. Syria did have a civil war, or it was going through a civil war, and still is. But a major impetus for that civil war is the sudden decision that by France, Britain, and but most of all the United States, that the present ruler, President Bashar al-Assad, has to go. Well, why is it up to America to say who should be the president of Syria? Now, there are internal problems in Syria, and there was opposition to Assad, and a lot of it was funded by our supposed allies in the Gulf states in Saudi Arabia, and that was all on religious grounds. Assad is a member of a group called the Alawites, and they're about 11% of the population of Syria. They're kind of a strange group. They consider themselves Muslims, but many Muslims think they're heretics. They're a very tight-knit group, and Assad and his group, his Alawites, have a great deal of power in Syria. And there are, of course, obviously people who don't like that. And but by meddling in that civil war and providing funds and training for some of the rebels, and the rebels are a very mixed group. Some are ISIS, some are, we're told, moderates, whatever that means, and they're very divided. But the result of meddling there in that civil war, and also giving out the signal that we want Assad gone, I mean, that's what Obama said. People would be outraged if a foreign power said the American president has to go. Well, we don't like him. The American people's choice is the wrong choice. You know, even though you and I might privately agree that's the wrong choice, but that's not up to a foreign power to say. So what we have in Syria is chaos and 4 million refugees, many of them wanting to go to Europe. And I don't think they should be allowed in. But once again, our meddling, or at least American meddling, has resulted in catastrophe. I suppose Ron Paul would say this, but I think the words of George Washington in his farewell address should be repeated every morning by every politician, and that was to beware of entangling alliances. Our meddling in foreign, essentially what he was talking about was meddling in foreign countries. The results are usually not pretty, and wars are easy to get into and often very hard to get out of. Chaos, misery, deaths, and so on, are the legacy. And I think we perhaps don't have to go any further than our own history in the 20th century. The First World War, all sides got into that. With heads full of romantic notions in beautiful cavalry uniforms, swords glistening in the sun, horses prancing, and they go into battle, and in a month or two they clean the enemy's clock, come home to wild applause, parades, girls jumping up and down, and so on. They didn't come home by Christmas, and they wouldn't be home for four more Christmases. And we basically massacred the white race on the fields of France in the First World War. Another bad idea.
Well, you're absolutely correct. World War I was probably the most unnecessary war. I've studied it in great detail, and I'm still trying to figure out why these people fought. The war, you had the British Empire, which was the largest empire in the world, and of course the Russian Empire under the Tsar was an extremely large landmass. I mean, the British Empire came out with an additional 1 million square miles out of World War I, amazingly enough, and one of the big problems they had was how do we administer it, how do we govern it, how do we keep it under control, and then much of it was in the Middle East. They divided up the old Ottoman Empire, and a huge problem for post-war Britain was how are they going to govern it and control it? And with the armistice and the ceasing of hostilities, separate and apart from negotiating a treaty and redrawing the map of the world, there was a huge problem with mutiny in the British Army. There were threats, credible threats of mutiny. People wanted to come home. This war had gone on for, as you say, many, many years, and it's not well known today, but the British did not institute the draft until 1917, 2.5 years into the war. They had relied on volunteers up until that point, and I think that in part explains the British reliance on false war propaganda and false accusations of atrocities and war crimes against the Germans, because they couldn't just scoop people up by throwing a net over them. They had to motivate them to enlist. And it's not easy to motivate people to go out and slaughter their fellow man. as they saw. So, but you had this problem, and Churchill said this at the end of World War One, in contemplating British policy in the Middle East and how do we divide up the old Ottoman Empire and who gets what. He said, "Our army is melting away." And part of the motivation for the so-called League of Nations and for America to come into the League was to grant to the United States mandates in the Middle East, which means American taxpayers and American 18-year-olds would be responsible for troop deployments indefinitely in the Middle Eastern region. Because remember, in 1917, when World War One was at its height, the Bolsheviks overthrew the Tsarist regime, and they were concerned about communist, invasion of the Middle East. I mean, we think of American garrisons in far off corners of the world to contain communism. That was the word that was used in the aftermath of World War II. We think of American troops being stationed in far parts of the world to contain communism in the context of the post-World War II period of time in the 1940s and in the 1950s. But in point of fact, the specter of Soviet expansion into the Middle East and proposals for American troops to be garrisoned in the Middle East go back to the end of World War One. I was astonished to find that out. But the League of Nations was in large part a gimmick by which the British Empire could maintain power over other countries, and it could consolidate and draw support from other countries for its colonial and imperialistic ventures in various parts of the world. And there's another aspect of the British post-World War One foreign policy in the Middle East, and that was the means by which they exercised power over that area. That area was kind of a seething cauldron of turmoil and factions and religious sectarian feuds and quarrels and tribes. And the Ottomans never really fully came to grips with it. The Ottomans controlled the major cities and the railroads and the major areas. But once you got outside the major areas, it was pretty much anything goes. And the institution of slavery was very, very much in evidence and was pretty much part of the human condition in the Middle East, even up through World War One, when the King Faisal came from Saudi Arabia to the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919. He brought one of his black slaves with him.
We'll pick that up at the other side of the break. We're taking a short break, and back with you, Paul Fromm and Donna Advo on Stormfront Radio.
And it wouldn't do an ounce of good to call my name, 'cause daddy's name wasn't Willie Woodrow, and I wasn't born and raised in no ghetto, just a white boy looking for a place to do my thing. Well, I'm out to find me.
Hi, this is Jeff Renson. I've never been much of a tea drinker until I was sent a sample of Life Change Tea. I actually didn't even brew it for several weeks after receiving it because I'm so busy. But then one day, some months ago, I had a feeling I might be missing out on something very special with this tea, and so I went down and made up a batch. And I haven't stopped drinking it since. Life Change Tea is a unique blend of natural herbs that gently gets rid of toxins, parasites, unwanted bacteria, chemicals, molds, and yeast. I mix mine in organic lemonade, but it tastes great no matter how you drink it. And how it makes you feel is even better. Life Change Tea is all natural and completely organic. You're invited to visit GetTheTea.com and browse through the many testimonials about this unique product. You can also order it online right now at GetTheTea.com. Or you can call directly at 928-308-0408, extension 2, and tell them I sent you. GetTheTea.com, that's GetTheTea.com.
We have a great story from someone who's helped themselves to heal by using the botanical known as Carnivora. And we have a guest right now. Her name is Joni Nichols. This is quite a story.
Yes, it is. And Robert, I was a mess. I had numerous infections. My hair was falling out all over the furniture. Mm-hmm. One of the scariest things was that my legs were swelling up out of control. It came to a head. Within 24 hours, I had gone into a coma.
Holy tamale.
Mom and Dad decided to get me carnivore as a six-week program. Within two weeks, Robert, the first thing I noticed was that I felt better waking up. Then I noticed that my hair wasn't all over the furniture. I'm like all excited.
And she credits all of it to her Carnivora protocol.
This is Richard Ostro, owner for Carnivora Research International. Call 1-866-836-8735. That's 1-866-836-8735 or visit carnivora.com, carnivora.com. Call now.
If you've been listening to this program for any length of time, you'll know that Fukushima, the greatest calamity in history, has now, as I've been warning since 3/11, killed off virtually the whole North Pacific Ocean and especially up and down the entire West Coast. The radiation is migrating inland and is moving across the entire country. There's only one proven defender to radiation exposure, the brilliant Chernobyl-proven discovery of Dr. Michael Kiriak, which combines the four most potent and powerful algaes on the planet, imported to the U.S. and known as Bio's Superfood. I've taken Bio's Superfood every day for several years now and want you to do the same for your sake and the health and safety of your family and loved ones. Take the banner at the top of Rents.com and prepare to learn how to save your life.
This is Paul Fromm back with you on Stormfront Radio, and with me is Don Advo. Don, I wonder if we could switch topics for just a moment. I'm out here in British Columbia in part of what I call the real Canada. This is not very multicultural, and boy, I feel a lot happier. It's not like Toronto or Vancouver. This is the real Canada. This is an old gold mining town. It's Quesnel, British Columbia. And if that doesn't ring a bell for most people, that's about 400 miles north and east of Vancouver, about 500 miles north and east of Seattle, Washington, up in the Caribou Mountains. This was gold rush country back in the 1850s. Anyway, freedom's on the line here in Quesnel. Arthur Topham is an old free thinker. He is kind of an old hippie in some ways, but he really began to look at Zionism back in 2007. He didn't like what he saw. So he's posted a lot of material on Zionism. He's put links to books like The Controversy of Zion, The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, this absolutely hateful blueprint for genocide called Germany Must Perish. And then Arthur did a satire on that. Wherever it said Germany or Germans, he put Israel and Israelis. And, of course, even the same type of cover. What he's trying to do is to show up the people who are really planning genocide or have planned genocide in this world. Theodore Kaufman wrote the book, Germany Must Perish, in 1941. And what he wanted to do at the end of the war was to sterilize the entire German population, and what he said was within two generations there'd be no more Germans. And not all, but some of what he recommended was in fact implemented after the Second World War. A million German civilians were deliberately starved to death after the war. The food was there. Former American President Herbert Hoover protested again and again that he was trying to deliver food, and he was obstructed. So after the war ended, by policy, a million German civilians were killed, and then a million surrendered German soldiers were not considered POWs, but were referred to as other losses, mostly because on orders of Dwight Eisenhower, they were kept in camps along the Rhine River. denied almost all food and water. There was no shelter. And over a six-month period, a million of them perished from starvation and disease. This was cold-blooded murder. You know, people like Eisenhower should have been in the dock at Nuremberg and should have hanged. Anyway, Arthur Topham is a real spirited guy. And among other accomplishments, he's a placer miner, which I found out means mining more or less in the style that you've seen in movies of the Old West, you know, with a pan and so on. It's a matter of scooping up gravel from creek beds and so on. But of course, there are new techniques that allow them to extract gold from would not have been possible a century ago. So he's a really interesting guy. If you want, people want to look at his website, it's radicalpress.com. Radicalpress.com. Arthur's a fine guy, and he's being charged under Canada's notorious hate law. He's charged with willfully promoting hatred against this kind of an odd charge against Jews as both a religion and a race. Well, we're going to have some interest and some fun with that. Well, what exactly are they? Are they a religion? Are they a race? Are they? Oh, anyway, what are they? Arthur is in a spirited fight. The first day of the trial was Monday, and Monday morning they chose the jury, eight women and four men. For the past 2.5 days, a former detective constable on the hate squad. Imagine a hate squad in a country that says it believes in free speech. The political police. Anyway, this detective sergeant, the detective constable, Terry Wilson, mostly identified downloads from the website. Some of what I mentioned in many articles that Arthur has written. And yesterday I was nearly dozing off, and I looked up at the screen and I said, I know that picture, that's me. I was on a ferry from Victoria to Vancouver back in 2008. There was a picture taken of me. And that illustrated an article I wrote about the fact that, and this would be, I guess, 3 years ago, the Supreme Court laid down a ruling that just absolutely savaged traditional Christianity, especially in expressions against homosexuality and so on. It really beat up on a fellow I know quite well named Bill Watcott. And I noted that the Supreme Court, the panel that decided this, consisted of six people. Three of them were Jews. Now, Jews constitute a little under 1% of our population, but at that point had over 33% of the nine-man Supreme Court. Anyway, that I guess I don't know if that's hate or whatever. Arthur didn't write it, but so this is going to be a real battle for free speech. Today, our lawyer will be cross-examining the policeman. We're trying to look at his methods and who gets to be charged and who doesn't. We already know that the complainants in this case were, not surprisingly, one of the British Columbia big noises for B'nai B'rith, the Jewish anti-free speech lobby group, and Richard Warman, who is a one-man complaint machine, going after people whose political views he doesn't like. And he comes from the very anti-racist, pro-Zionist far left. We'll be having that.
This is a criminal case? A criminal prosecution?
Criminal, yes. Absolutely. He could go to jail for 2 years and face a big fine. Plus other things. And see, I don't want to minimize jail. But you see, what's often done in these cases is there will be conditions. He'll be hit with parole conditions. And I'm pretty sure the parole condition will be to shut down his website. That's what it's all about.
May I ask a question about jury selection up there?
Yes.
Do you know how that's conducted? Do the lawyers get to question the potential jurors and challenge them for bias or cause?
Well, it's not like the United States. It's very, very deferential. The lawyers get the name of the juror, I think probably the age, and their occupation. And that's not much to go on. Now, each lawyer gets four peremptory challenges, which means that they don't have to give a reason. They can just say no. But of course, one of the things we're looking for, we don't want, an outright Zionist on the jury, a confirmed anti-racist. Well, it's hard to tell. And I pressed both our lawyer in this case, and his name is Barclay Johnson from Victoria, and years ago, Canada's premier free speech lawyer, Doug Christie. And it's not quite like in the States. You have to be very careful. Well, we'll be back with you just on the other side of the break. This is Paul Fromm.
Me want to refuse to care, refuse to care, to watch this all unfold, too much to bear. If this is the way it ends.
I'd like to invite you to take a look at some of the most important products in the realm of health and hygiene I've ever seen, all from Trioxy. As many of you know, ozone oxygen is highly effective for many different uses in the home or office place, from purifying the air you breathe to the water you drink. In fact, the city of Los Angeles, among others, uses ozone to purify the drinking water for millions. Uses of ozonated water produced by the Trioxy Pure include washing your hands, disinfecting cuts and infections, brushing your teeth, and even washing and sanitizing fruits and vegetables in the kitchen. Meanwhile, the Trioxy Re-Ion ozone negative ion generator will clean your indoor air of pollen, smoke, odors, mold, bacteria, and viruses, and more, and will put extra oxygen into your bloodstream and clean your body just by you being there. I hope you'll drop by and visit GoHealthyNext.com and take a look. The prices are more than affordable, and the results are priceless. That's GoHealthyNext.com.
Do you struggle with your weight? Are you frustrated or discouraged? Think you've tried everything to lose weight? Tired of weight loss products that promise results and don't deliver? There are 12 main reasons why you struggle with excess weight and have a difficult time losing it. From overeating to hormonal imbalances, an underactive thyroid, even sleep problems, and even dieting itself. The truth is, the 12 causes of weight loss problems are all addressed by one product, Royal Velvet. You, yes you, can join the scores of Rinse listeners who have stopped the madness and no longer struggle with weight issues. Maybe you've heard them talk with Jeff about their amazing transformations on his show. Simply go to RoyalVelvetNow.com. Click on the weight loss section and learn the truth about the real reason obesity is a deadly epidemic that you can avoid. Then click on the Rinse icon in the upper right-hand corner and you will be on your way to a healthier, slimmer, more youthful you. RoyalVelvetNow.com. Your life will never be the same.
The world is changing, and not for the better. You need to get ready, and soon. Get ready with ReadySupplyFoods.com. Ready with GMO-free 25-year food. Ready with the most calories per dollar of any storage food. In an emergency, calories mean survival. The USDA recommends a 2,000-calorie daily diet. At that rate, most other 30-day kits won't even last you 2 weeks. You need to get the most nutrition for your dollar, and ReadySupplyFoods.com sells the most calories per dollar of any company. Ready Supply Foods doesn't sell empty calories in the form of sugary drinks and desserts. Our 23 entrees and breakfasts are delicious and full of nutritious calories. Ready Supply Foods is the new leader in value and quality. Go to ReadySupplyFoods.com to see a comparison of the leading companies. You'll see that Ready Supply Foods sells you 50% more food for your money. Go to ReadySupplyFoods.com today.
Stormfront Radio. This is Paul Fromm filling in for Don Black, who's on his way to the Stormfront Conference in East Tennessee. And if you haven't registered and want to go right on Stormfront, joining with me is another regular on their show, Don Advo from as he calls him, Mexican-occupied Southern California. Don, you know, symbols are really important. And as you go into this courtroom in Quesnel, British Columbia, and you look up over the where the judge sits above his dais there, it was a big symbol of the Queen. Now, people may wonder, why do we have that? But the head of state in Canada actually is the Queen. So there's her crest, and it's quite a beautiful crest with a golden crown, a golden lion rampant, a white unicorn, and other symbols inside. And, you know, it's quite official-looking and encouraging. And somebody pointed out to me, did you look up at the ceiling? So, in other words, above the crest, right on the ceiling of the court. And I had to admit I hadn't yet. And there, sure enough, were four big and I mean big. They're probably 6 feet in diameter. Four light holders, and they're set down from the wall, the ceiling a little bit, and they're Stars of David. No kidding. Four Stars of David, and hanging from each of these Stars of David are six lamps. So six plus six more. Now I'm not really into numerology, and I'm, you know, not a conspiracy theorist, although sometimes there are conspiracies. But what does one make of this? Here is a secular court. If there'd been a Christian cross in there, there'd be hell to pay. You know, we believe all religions are equal. Blah 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 blah. What are these Stars of David doing in a courtroom? I'm waiting for one of the, well, our lawyer to say something. It is absolutely bizarre, but I mean symbolically, what it seems to be saying is, who has power above the Queen or the elected government in Canada? I mean, maybe that's not what it means, but symbolically, it sure spooked a number of our supporters.
Well, that is pretty shocking. That is really mind blowing. They have a Star of David in a courtroom. I remember when I was, you know, many years ago, I went downtown to Los Angeles Superior Court for what's called a trial setting conference, and you just go in with your calendar and you get a date. And I was preparing for another lawyer, but the judge who was sitting up there obviously was a Jewish guy. He had on a yarmulke, but he had on a big gold Star of David on his on a chain around his neck. I didn't think anything out of it at the time. I just wanted to get my date, you know, and get the hell out of there because I had a whole bunch, about 10 other things to do that day. But it occurs to me, and I've been in chambers where they have the menorah sitting on the desk in the judge's chambers and things like that, and they're very, very open about displaying their power and their sentiments. And, I mean, I agree with you that if a Christian symbol were displayed in a courtroom, I think if a judge wore a cross around his neck, there would be hell to pay. But the Jewish power is everywhere. It is ubiquitous, and it's unchallenged, and it's taken for granted. It is just taken for granted that these people can say and do pretty much anything they want without answering to anyone. And the people who are supposedly the most persecuted people in history are the most numerous. While all of the people who persecuted them have long since passed from the earth, you know, the ancient Egyptians, the Hittites, the Canaanites. Boy, read the Old Testament and look what happened to those people. So that is very startling to me. I don't know if the temperament and of the courtroom and, you know, the sentiment of the people, but I think an American lawyer would really raise hell about that. Or perhaps should raise hell about it and make some issue about it. What are these things done here? And I would demand that they be removed from the courtroom, or that we change to a different courtroom, because it unfairly biases my client to have. Or maybe you let it stay there and you use that in a closing argument to the jury. You know, hey, look up here. This is a secular courtroom, and here they've got their own symbols. Clearly, they have power over this court that we don't have. What are the defenses? What are the legal defenses to this charge? Is truth a defense, or is it simply a subjective thing? What was the person's state of mind?
No, it's not like the human rights charges that we actually got that rid of that law. But there are defenses. One of them is truth. One of them is sincerely held religious belief. That probably doesn't apply in our case. Another is very, very vague. Discussion of topics that are in the public interest. That would obviously fit. The other thing is that you can say hateful things if you're trying to expose hatred. And that may actually be quite powerful because Arthur is very concerned about some of the just psychotically anti-German material that's been put out over the years, and much of it by Jews, books like that book that Germany Must Perish. So there are defenses, but they're not quite as easy to establish as you might think. You say, well, truth is a defense. Okay, well, how do you prove the truth of something? And that's not necessarily easy, but this is going to be a real battle. You know, about Jewish power, I think there's an old adage that you should keep your mouth shut and your eyes and ears open. So there wasn't enough room to sit down when they were selecting the jury on Monday morning. So I was standing in the crowd of people who'd been called for jury duty and waiting to be further selected. Those who were selected would be called up front, and there wouldn't be much questioning, but there'd be a little bit of questioning, and then they'd be selected or not. Well, anyway, I was standing beside a woman who's a rancher, and she said, somebody asked her, well, what's the trial all about? Well, she sort of had it in a vague way. She said, well, something about hate propaganda. I don't really know, she said. But she said, you can't say anything these days that isn't politically correct. We don't have freedom, she said. You can't say anything. And, you know, I thought in kind of a generalized way, that woman understood. She didn't have the specifics, but she knew that if something was politically incorrect, it might be dangerous to say it or to write about it. Now, to be fair, it isn't quite that bad. You have to be fairly forceful the way Arthur is, but more dangerously is you can be fired. In our next newsletter, Free Speech Monitor, I'm going to be outlining cases of people right across the country who were fired for nothing more than maybe an ill-advised comment on Facebook. They're not even necessarily ideological. One person made fun of Muslims on his Facebook, and he's fired. Yeah, it has nothing to do with his job. So there's a fear out there. And that woman who I overheard talking to another person, I thought characterized that very well. You know, people know we're not a free country. And that's scary, to be here in what I call the real Canada, not the big multicultural sewers of cities. And even out here, where there are a lot more, free-thinking, independent people. People are scared. It's bad news.
I don't know much about the demographics up there, but I would think that in a remote area like that, where it is primarily a white population, that you would get a much better jury pool than you would get in Toronto or Victoria. Is that the... Vancouver. Yeah. Vancouver is a big city.
Vancouver's not the big city.
Yeah, I visited Vancouver as a child many years ago. It was quite beautiful then. Right. I don't know what now, of course, but...
You're right. This is our hope, that this is a more traditional area of Canada. Also, being a small town, it's 15,000 people, the defendant, Arthur Topham, is well known. He's lived here for over 30 years. He ran it before RadicalPress.com became just a website. It was also a tabloid, a newspaper. He's taught school in this area. So he's kind of a known factor. Known, and I think well-liked. The chances of getting a fair trial here with a jury are a lot better than in a big city. Nothing's for sure, but that's one of the reasons I think both Arthur and his attorney have opted for to go with a jury.
Well, juries have traditionally been seen as a bulwark against tyranny. When the United States had its alien and sedition laws in the late 1700s, which made criticism of the government or denigrating the president a crime, juries in the South were very, very hostile to that law, and a lot of publishers and newspaper people and pamphleteers and what have you went to the South because they wanted to be arrested and tried. It was generally true that Southern juries would acquit, whereas Northern juries were more likely to convict. And that was the reason I asked that question, because you're that's a very interesting trial. That's an awfully challenging, daunting task. I recently was involved in a First Amendment case earlier this year in Kentucky on behalf of one of our activists there. Of course, he had a sign protesting Martin Luther King, a Martin Luther King Day observance in a public building. And before anybody arrived there, he arrived early, and he had his signs, two signs, and he was arrested by the police and prosecuted for trespassing. And I had an uphill battle on that. We ultimately got the case resolved. He promised not to sue for civil rights violations, and they agreed to dismiss the criminal case. Interestingly enough, the statute they prosecuted him under didn't even apply to buildings. It only applied to unimproved land, separate and apart from the First Amendment issues. But it's very hard, even in the United States, to get a fair trial on a free speech issue for a white person who's not publishing pornography. Pornography is almost presumptively deemed to be constitutionally protected and defensible in the minds of so many people in this very corrupt culture that we have. So I guess I hear the music.
Don, thanks for joining us. This is Paul Fromm on Stormfront Radio. Tune in again tomorrow from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time.
Are you prepared for the future? Do you know how to navigate past the upcoming dangers before it's too late and seize budding opportunities before others do? Forecasting worldwide since 1980, Gerald Celeni, publisher of the Trends Journal, provides timely and accurate trend forecasts that have earned him the reputation as the most trusted name in trends. The proof is in the hundreds of accurate forecasts Celeni has made over the past 30 years. The 1987 stock market crash, the clean food trend, the dot-com bust. The Trends Journal alerts subscribers to early subtle signs of crucial trends that will shape our future. It allows readers to anticipate change, recognize the implications, and take proactive strategies. Put your money where your mind is with Gerald Celeni's brilliant and indispensable Trends Journal. Go to trendsjournal.com or call 845-331-3500. That's 845-331-3500. Hi, this is Jeff Rentz. Royal Raymond Rife was without question the most gifted medical scientific genius of our age. He discovered that most disease-related microbes die quickly when exposed to their own specialized resonant radio frequencies. The BCX-411 Rife Type Frequency Instrument has received the highest praise on several continents for its precision, simplicity of operation, and successful research experiment. The BCX, with its comprehensive manual, allows you to select the frequencies you wish to experiment with for the length of time you want to run them. The BCX handheld plasma ray tubes and RF radio carrier wave, like Rife used, are the absolute state-of-the-art in Rife frequency research. For full information and pictures, take the New Earth link at the top of Rentz.com. Settle for nothing but the best in Rife research with the BCX 411. Again, just take the New Earth link at the top left corner of Rentz.com.
This is True News Headlines. I'm Kelly Sloan. The third GOP presidential debate was held last night on CNBC. Texas Senate